So what I'm going to do this evening is try to explore the sixth verse of the puja, the entreaty and supplication. I know that Surigupta spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, but I'm going to try to approach it in a different sort of way. At least I hope I am. No doubt Surigupta will let me know if I don't at the end of the class. But I wanted to start, actually, rather than sort of speaking straight away about opening ourselves to higher influences and how we do that through the imagination and so forth, I wanted to go right back and look at the words themselves, so that the sixth section of the puja is entitled Entreaty and Supplication. And normally when we explain this, when we talk about it, we say, well, this represents an openness the teaching, a willingness to listen and to receive. It's sort of symbolic of receptivity, you could say. But I was thinking about these words earlier today, entreaty and supplication. They're very strong words. It's not just that we're asking for something, although of course that's implied. Definitely you're implying, you're asking something, you're requesting something. It's a request for the teaching, but it's an entreaty, it's a supplication. When I think of the word entreaty, what comes to my mind immediately are the novels of Anthony Trollope and Charles Dickens especially, and probably Jane Austen and others as well, where, you know, the hero goes to see the lady of his choice, gets down on his bended knee, and begs her to marry him. And of course she says no. So then they both go through various trials and tribulations, usually over a period of a year or two. And finally the hero comes back and begs the lady of his choice for the second time. And this time she says no again. I'm just kidding. Of course the second time she usually says yes. So, you know, when I think of entreaty, that's a sort of image that comes to my mind. You know, the Victorian, the hero of a Victorian novel, coming to beg the lady of his choice, the heroine, in fact, of the novel, to be his wife. There's a certain earnestness about that. And what these words mean, both entreaty and supplication, is that they have these connotations of imploring, of begging, of beseeching. So they're very, very strong words. It's more than just asking, will you marry me? It's more, you know, please marry me. You know, I'm desperate. I just want you. Will you please marry me? It's that kind of spirit that we have to bring to this. Totally different context, of course. So entreaty and supplication, it's got more that kind of feel to it than just merely asking. I think it's also important to bear in mind that it's not demanding. You get nothing if you demand it in a dharmic context, absolutely nothing. You can't demand the Dharma. You might say, for example, you might think that it is your right to be taught the Dharma. Well, it's not. The Dharma, of course, is needed by everybody, and the Dharma should be freely available to everybody. But if you come with an attitude of I demand to be taught, well, immediately there's an attempt there to sort of force you to teach, something of that sort. You're bringing force to bear within the situation, and that's not going to work. Even if someone came to me and demanded to be taught the Dharma, even if with the best will in the world I tried, I probably wouldn't succeed. I could probably tell them all about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, but how much use that will be to them, it's very difficult to know. Probably not much, frankly. Sangharakshita, the founder of the Triratna Buddhist community, famously said that the Dharma is caught, not taught. Of course, that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't try to teach the Dharma, and as you can see, we do that. But you're more likely to learn what the Dharma really is all about, how to put it into practice, how to benefit from it, by coming into contact with people who themselves are practicing the Dharma. This is why we push the idea of getting you onto retreat so hard, because it gives you an opportunity to mix with others who are trying to practice the Dharma together. And you know, that practice rubs off. It rubs off on each and every person present. That's how you pick it up, really. You find the spirit of the thing. Of course, it's important to understand the sort of the basic principles of the Dharma, and we do try to explain them very, very clearly when we teach here. It's really important that we have that basic grasp of the Dharma. But really, in the end, the Dharma is caught, not taught. I often think, in this regard, I often bring to mind the example of Angulimala. Angulimala did become one of the great, he became one of the enlightened disciples of the Buddha. But when the Buddha first encountered him, he was a long, long way from enlightenment. He was what nowadays would be described as a serial killer. He'd killed 107 people up to the point that he encountered the Buddha, apparently. And he was killing people so that he could make him a garland of 108 fingers from different bodies. And he had thought of, for the 108th victim, he'd thought about his mother, hard, seriously. But as fate would have it, the Buddha just happened to be walking along the path that led by Angulimala's hideout. Apparently he'd terrorized the entire area. People were well aware of him, and they were aware that the Buddha walking alone down this road was not a good idea. The Buddha was not to be put off, however, and he walked down this road alone, knowing full well, presumably, that Angulimala would not be able to resist and come out and attack him. And that's precisely what Angulimala tried to do. He wasn't looking for a teacher. He was looking for a victim, number 108. Something very, very strange happened, which was that apparently the Buddha was walking at his normal, natural pace, very mindfully, very slowly. Angulimala was charging at him, running hard, running as hard as he could, and he couldn't get anywhere near the Buddha. The faster he ran, no matter how fast he ran, he didn't seem to get any closer to the Buddha. And after some time, he yelled out in desperation, "Stop, recluse!" And the Buddha simply replied very calmly, "I have stopped, Angulimala." This is while he's continuing to walk. "You too stop." And this completely befuddled the mind of Angulimala. He wasn't expecting anything of this sort. It sort of shocked him into a different state of mind, I suppose. He just could not it was just almost like a spiritual shock. He just couldn't understand why he was saying to him, "Stop." Anyway, what happened, to cut a long story short, was that Angulimala became one of the Buddha's disciples and eventually became enlightened. But if you like, the Buddha taught Angulimala. But Angulimala wasn't seeking a teaching. He didn't ask for a teaching. He didn't seem to be particularly interested in the teaching, but he got a teaching in a sense. But what that teaching amounted to was a communication between the Buddha and Angulimala. Something happened between the two of them, which ultimately meant that Angulimala gained enlightenment. He certainly became a follower of the Buddha, put the Buddha's teachings into practice, and eventually gained enlightenment. So that, to my mind, is a dramatic example of the Dharma being caught, not taught. Now, that doesn't mean to say that people didn't go around asking the Buddha for teachings, or that people don't go and ask for teachings from other teachers in Buddhist tradition. This does happen, of course. And there's a very famous instance of this with a man called Bahia of the bark garment in the text. That's how he's described. bark garment, perhaps because he had been some sort of shaman. We don't really know why he's described in this way. Anyway, without going into the details, Bahia had a dream in which he heard that there was an enlightened one on the other side of India. Bahia was staying in a place called Suparika, which is near modern-day Bombay. And the Buddha was a long, long way away from that in the area around modern-day Bihar. But Bahia was determined. He'd heard that there was this enlightened being in this particular place. So he left for this place and took in a very short space of time, seemed to arrive in Bihar or wherever it was the Buddha was staying, and found out where that when he arrived at the Buddha's sort of the place where the Buddha was lodging, the Buddha was actually out on an arms round, and his disciples said, "Look, it's not the right time to go and ask the Buddha for a teaching now. Wait until he's finished his arms round." But Bahia would not wait. He went out. He sought the Buddha. He went straight up to him and begged him for a teaching. The Buddha said, "It's not the right time, because I'm on my arms round." Bahia then said, "But the span of life of the Tathagata and myself, that's to say, of the Buddha and myself, is not known. There's a danger in this. Give me a teaching, please." So the Buddha said a second time, "No, it wasn't the right time." Bahia pressed him for the third time. So, as was always the case with the Buddha, if he's asked three times, well, he would answer whatever question was put to him, and so he gave Bahia a teaching. And the teaching was such that Bahia gained enlightenment on the spot. This is very uncommon, by the way. There's no other instance of this. Bahia is known in tradition as the quickest to enlightenment. And what the Buddha said to Bahia was, "In the seen, just the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the cognized, just the cognized. In the imagined, just the imagined." He said a bit more than that, actually, but that's the core part of what he said to Bahia. And Bahia immediately understood and gained enlightenment. And interestingly, shortly afterwards, within a matter of hours, he died. So Bahia approached the Buddha with a tremendous sense of urgency, and he asked the Buddha. He was desperate. He wanted an answer. He really wanted an answer to his question. Will you give me a teaching? Will you teach me the Dharma? He entreated the Buddha. He traveled from one side of India to the other to listen, to hear what the Buddha had to say. Again, it's this kind of spirit, so it seems to me, that's implied by this section in the puja. You really do want to hear the Dharma. It's a matter, perhaps, even of life and death to you. It's a matter of great urgency. To my mind, it has that kind of feel to it, entreaty and supplication, or these words in a Dharmic context. That's what they convey, or I think that's what they're intended to convey. So we ask, presumably, we entreat for something that we want. In this context, it's the context of entreating for the Dharma. But let's just sort of broaden that out a bit further. I want to ask a few questions in a hope that this might sort of shed a bit more light on what is intended by this whole idea of entreaty and supplication, or this teaching of entreaty and supplication. We usually entreat for something that we really want. But the first question that arises is, do we know what we want? Do we really, truly know what we want? To go back to another traditional story, in one of the Mahayana scriptures, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, Sariputra, who was one of the Buddha's two chief disciples, is amongst a great gathering of monks, nuns, arahants, bodhisattvas, devas, gods, that is, and other non-human beings, and they're travelling towards the house of the layman Vimalakirti, and they're travelling with Manjushri, the great bodhisattva of wisdom. And there's going to be some kind of discourse between these two, between Vimalakirti and Manjushri. So when they arrive at Vimalakirti's house, Sariputra looks around the house and notices that there's no furniture. And thinks, the thought passes through his mind, there isn't even a single chair in this house. Where are all these Buddhas, I beg your pardon, Bodhisattvas, Arahants, monks and nuns, lay people, Devas, etc., etc.? Where are they going to sit? And Vimalakirti understands that this thought is in his mind, and simply asks him the question, Sariputra, did you come here for the Dharma? Or did you come here for the sake of a chair? Now, of course, the Sariputra in this text is not the Sariputra of the Pali Canon, the earlier texts of Buddhist tradition. The Sariputra is a kind of fall guy in the Mahayana scriptures, as representing the Arahants, the limited ideal from the Mahayana perspective of the Buddhist ideal, the ideal of gaining enlightenment just for yourself. But within the Mahayana tradition, the ideal is to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all others. So the Mahayana is sending up Sariputra a little bit here. Sariputra, of course, was renowned for his great wisdom. He was the wisest of all the Buddha's disciples, and not acting particularly wisely, it seems, in this Mahayana context. So, certainly as represented in this text, Sariputra doesn't really know what he wants. He thinks he's come to listen to the Dharma, or he wants the Dharma, but actually he's looking for a comfortable place to sit, or wondering where all the other people are going to sit, or where all the other beings are going to sit. So, do we really know what we want? I think very often we don't. I don't know how many of you have seen Tarkovsky's wonderful film, Stalker. I showed it here recently on one of the film nights that we've started having on Saturday night. There's no film which has had such a positive impact upon me in the whole course of my life as that, Tarkovsky's film, Stalker. I've seen it many times, I'm sure I'll see it many times again. And one of the things that struck me most about this film when I first saw it, and I saw it first of all when it was initially released in the late 70s, and I really didn't understand what on earth was going on in the film, I have to say. It completely bamboozled me, but it totally intrigued me, and I was totally absorbed in it, and I knew that I had to see it again immediately. So I went back to see the film again the following evening. I've only ever done that once again in the whole course of my life, but I had to see it, and of course I didn't understand it any better the second time around. It still baffles me, really, but what struck me, one of the things that struck me about the film nonetheless, was that in the film, the film centres on an area in a country, an unknown country, probably Russia, certainly it's in the Russian language, an area which has been kind of zoned off. It's called the zone, and it's protected by military-looking guards, and you can't get in there. It's a very dangerous place, but people want to get in there. They want to get in there because at the heart of the zone, somewhere in a house, in a ruined house, there's a room, and in that room, if you can find your way to that room, your deepest, most heartfelt wish will be realized. So obviously this is a very attractive idea, isn't it? You go to the room and you get what you most want. So in the film, there's the stalker. And the stalker is the man who guides those who seek to go into this room and have their heartfelt wish realized. But to get into the zone is dangerous in the first place, but once you're in the zone, it becomes even more dangerous. You can't go into the zone without the guidance of the stalker. So in the film, the stalker guides two men. Interestingly, one's a scientist and the other's an arty type, he's a writer. And they go into the zone together. And they have to go that you can't go straight to the room. Of course, the stalker knows exactly where the room is, but he can't go straight there because the zone plays tricks on you. You have to go very, very carefully, proceed very, very carefully. And you can't follow the same route every time because the safe route is different every time. So it's very tricky. So the three of them follow this very, very difficult path right into the heart of the zone. And one of the most dangerous areas in the zone, and you always have to go through this, is called the grinder. So you have to go all the way through the grinder to reach the house where this room is. It's a very, very dangerous place. It's the most dangerous place in the zone. And one person has to go ahead to make sure it's safe for the others. And it's never going to be the stalker. It always has to be one of the other people. Anyway, they go through that. They gradually work their way through the grinder safely, as it happens, by sheer luck. And many people have lost their lives in the grinder. And it transpires that the stalker was trained by another stalker, a man who's referred to as the porcupine, or just porcupine, that's it, porcupine. And slowly we find out that porcupine did something very foolish, but it started off on the basis of tragedy. The tragedy was his brother, the brother of porcupine, that is, wanted to go into the room. And so porcupine sent his brother on ahead in the grinder to reach the room. Unfortunately, he didn't survive. He died in the grinder. So porcupine then went through to the place where the room was located and did the one thing that he knew that the stalker must never do, that is to say, enter the room himself. But he entered the room himself because he felt so terrible at the loss of his brother. He wanted his brother to be returned to life. So he went into the room and wished for his brother to be returned to life. Because, of course, he felt responsibility for his brother's death. And when Porcupine left the zone, he discovered to his horror that he'd become fabulously wealthy. And as a consequence, committed suicide. So this story, and it's only part of the film, but this story really, really struck me. And it made me realise that to know what you really want is not an easy thing. It means that you must have tremendous self-knowledge, and that calls for great honesty and openness to your experience, to really know what you want. What is your most heartfelt desire? So it's not an easy thing to know what you most want. So when we entreat for the Dharma, what are we entreating for? Do we really want the Dharma, or do we want something else? Perhaps in the case of Sariputra, he was actually dreaming about something else. I mean, not the real Sariputra, but the Sariputra of the Mahayana scriptures. But we may also ask ourselves, well, why do we come here? What do we expect? What do we hope for by coming along here? I mean, I'm hoping and I imagine that for all of you, it's something very, very positive. But do you know what you most want? Is the Dharma that important to you? Is it the most important thing in your life? Well, of course, probably the answer to that you would give would be no, I imagine. Although maybe not, I don't know, maybe it is. But how do we know what is most important to us? It's not an easy thing to work out. And I'm not going to try to answer that question. I think to really know what you want, what you most want, as I say, it requires honesty and openness to your own experience. But I think it also requires a certain objectivity. Very often we think we want something, only to be disappointed by it, even when we get that thing. For example, this so often happens in human relationships. We want to be with a particular person because we imagine or we feel or we expect them to have certain qualities, which in reality they don't. And we get disappointed as a consequence. In other words, we engage in psychological projection in our relations with others so often. And then when things don't work out, when the real person becomes a bit more clear to us, we blame them for our own disappointment. And this happens so often in life. We thought that we wanted that person, but actually, in the end, we didn't. We wanted something else, something which eludes us. So it's not an easy thing to know what you truly want. But let's say that we do know what we want, and we want the Dharma. We want it desperately. This was a situation with Milarepa, of whom some of you will at least have heard. Milarepa was a great Tibetan yogi, perhaps the greatest, certainly one of the greatest yogis of Tibetan Buddhism. And he also happened to be Tibet's greatest poet. He's a singer, and he sung his songs, and his songs have come down to us as poetry, really. Milarepa, if you like, became a Buddhist, he was a black magician. And he was responsible for the deaths of many people, up to 40 people, according to the tradition. And he realized at a certain point that he'd caused so much harm and pain, he'd acted so badly, that if he died without gaining enlightenment, then he would go straight to a state of suffering. And this terrified him. And so he sought out a teacher. He sought out, he knew he needed to gain enlightenment in this life if he was to avoid that fate. That was what he believed anyway. So he sought his teacher, and he eventually came into contact with Marpa, his teacher, and begged Marpa to teach him. But Marpa wouldn't teach him. To begin with, he took him on as a disciple. He said, "Yes, I will teach you, but not yet." He just set Milarepa to work. In fact, he made him build 3 towers and then demolish them one after another. It seemed to be quite a long time before Marpa actually taught him anything. And Milarepa kept begging him, "Please teach me. Please give me the teachings, the core teachings." And Marpa would never agree. And in the end, Milarepa was reduced to a suicidal state. And finally, Marpa relented and gave him the teachings that he needed. But Milarepa, clearly, he entreated, he wanted the teaching, but he wasn't quite ready yet. The fact is that very often we're not ready for the teachings that we seek. There's a lot of Buddhist teachings out there on the internet, for example. You can find teachings from all traditions, so-called esoteric traditions. It's all out there on the internet. You can be given initiations into meditation practices, which before would only be passed down from guru to disciple. But you can get these over the internet these days. So we're able to get those things without really having to work for them, without really having to prepare ourselves for them. But it doesn't work like that. We need to prepare ourselves. We need to somehow open ourselves up to the higher influences, which is represented by the entreaty and supplication section of the puja. Maybe I'll just pause there and see if you have any questions. So far. Yeah?
What does supplication mean?
The same thing as entreaty, basically. To plead, to beg, to beseech. But there may be some slight slight difference in the connotations, but basically it's the same thing. You know, a heartfelt desire for something and request. But what it represent, what the entreaty and supplication represents in the puja, is it's like a sort of a statement that we're open. We're open to teaching. You know, you've gone through various stages in the puja. You've purified yourself through confession. You've committed yourself through going for refuge, and so on. You've got yourself into a positive state of rejoicing through the rejoicing and the rejoicing in merit. And now you entreat for the teaching. You've gone through a process whereby you've created a positive state of mind for yourself, a mind which is going to be open to the higher influences represented by the Dharma, which we try to access, especially through the imagination. But it's an entreaty, it's a heartfelt wish. Is that the only question? Yeah.
Could you just say something more about imagination? Because from what little reading I've done, it does seem to be the case that the type of imagination that you're speaking of isn't just whims and fancy.
No.
It seems to be a deeper faculty of mind.
Well, I mean, we make a distinction between something which is generated by imagination, and something which is pure fantasy. Something which is a fantasy is unreal, but the imagination is the creativity of the mind coming alive, and that's what one reason why we encourage so much engagement with the fine arts, reading of going to see paintings, going to what we're reading the great literature, reading poetry, and so on. It helps to stimulate the imagination within us. And the imagination seeks beauty, actually. I mentioned Tarkovsky earlier, the great Russian filmmaker. And he speaks a lot about this, seeking truth, seeking beauty, as a filmmaker. For him, filmmaking really was an art. Does that get any closer? And for instance, when we do the sevenfold puja, it's poetry, and it's the poetry is designed to stimulate. Well, design is not the right word, but it's there to evoke the sensations of the moods that are being written about. The positive states of mind, if you like, that are being written about, trying to bring them into effect, trying to stimulate your imagination so that they can arise. I mean, that's why we chant mantras. Mantras don't mean anything, but they're symbolic of some higher experience. And if we just allow our minds to dwell upon them, if we recite them, then it can stimulate that higher experience. Bring it into existence, or at least some kind of inkling of that, help us to come into contact with it. Well, since there seem to be no more questions, why don't we try and invoke something? What I'd like to do... Well, maybe I'll tell you one more story before we do it. I've got to do this, but I wanted to tell you a story from Japan. And then we'll recite a mantra. The Buddha on the shrine here is the Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha of the West. And Amitabha is a very important figure in Japanese Buddhism. And There's a story of an old woman who used to go to a temple regularly, and in the temple there was a very large image of Amitabha, and she was a devotee of Amitabha, it seems, and she'd go to the temple every day, and she would entreat the Buddha Amitabha to come and take her to the Pure Land. Oh, Amitabha, please come now, I'm ready, please come and take me. I'm so fed up with this terrible world, this samsara, please come for me. And she'd go and do this every afternoon, day after day after day, apparently. And one of the monks in this particular temple noticed this and heard the same story every afternoon. So on one occasion, he decided to anticipate her arrival, hid himself behind the large Buddha statue, and just at the height of her, shall we call it, invocation of Amitabha, he bawled out from the back, "I'm coming for you now!" And she jumped up with absolute horror and darted for the temple door, and then looked back and said, "Won't the Buddha let me have my little joke?" clearly, she didn't really mean what she was calling for. So we're not going to do it in that spirit. But I suppose that one lesson to be learned from that is,